I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, is there a move by Republicans to remove Dick Cheney from office? We'll have a conversation about the power of the vice president. But first, the House Committee on Foreign Affairs held a hearing today to consider the question, is the surge in Iraq working? Here's Gary Ackerman, Democratic congressman from New York.
What ails Iraq cannot be fixed with more American military power. No matter how you try, you can't fix a wristwatch with a sledgehammer. Our military is the wrong tool for this job. You can't use tanks to build a functioning cabinet ministry. You can't use F-15s to build a national consensus. You can't root out corruption with artillery. Even our special operations units, the very best of the best, can't train effective security forces out of people who view the United States as the enemy.
Today's hearing comes as two top Republican senators, previously reluctant to criticize President Bush, said his current strategy in Iraq is not working. Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana spoke this weekend. George Voinovich of Ohio released a letter yesterday in which he recently told the president, "We must begin a transition in which the Iraqi government and its neighbors play a larger role in stabilizing Iraq." Well, George Lubold covers the Pentagon for the Christian Science Monitor. He's following today's hearings. And Gordon, because of Lugar and Voinovich, Maine's Olympia Snow says the tide is turning for her party. But what did you hear today at the hearing? Did you hear anything new?
I heard a new framing of the debate on Iraq, which is now, as the chairman of the committee spoke earlier, a Democrat from California, Tom Lantos, said it's not if, but when troops are redeployed from Iraq.
And how did the Republicans weigh in on that?
There's still some mixed views, but increasingly, and in part because of Senator Lugar's comments 2 days ago, there's more cover now to be more openly questioning and asking for real questions to be answered.
Yeah. We do know that, at least from the opening statements, at least some Republicans are still taking the wait-and-see approach. Here's Gresham Barrett, Republican from South Carolina.
I'm very proud of what the military is doing. I have met with General Petraeus. I was with him Memorial Day, and I sincerely want to let our military change course every day, which is what they're doing, to face an enemy that we must face overseas, or indeed we will face them here again in the streets of the United States.
Was that an isolated comment, or was there much of that opinion?
Many people still share that, but I think what's changing is that this notion that the U.S. military can't do it, as one of your clips suggested. You know, tanks aren't going to fix the Iraqi government, and with the increasing violence in Iraq, even with the surge and more forces there, the political reconciliation process that this whole surge is supposed to support has yet to take hold, and patience is just running out. It's coming at the same time that U.S. commanders in Iraq are saying, well, September we'll do an assessment, but it may take a little bit longer for us to really figure out what's going on there.
Yeah, there seems to be some language of late in particular that's signaling that September isn't going to be the definitive moment that many thought.
No, but increasingly members of Congress who were waiting for September's assessment to tell them something are doubly frustrated because the goal line keeps moving forward.
Well, the hearing also heard today from Anthony Cordesman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's an analyst who's been on this program frequently. He said that a quick pullout could result in increased influence in the region by Iran. He also talked about al-Qaeda, urging lawmakers to consider al-Qaeda's international reach.
I have to say that one of the most dangerous statements I have heard made is that this is the center of al-Qaeda's operations. It is not. We are talking about a network and structure which is international in character, which will be a major threat whether we win or lose in Iraq.
How is Anthony Cordesman received?
Well, he's a respected scholar and academic and off-cited here. He is echoing the concern that counters what the Bush administration says about we bring forces home and the bad guys will follow us. It's not necessarily seen as a true justification for keeping U.S. forces there indefinitely.
Well, Lieutenant General Jack Stultz, head of the U.S. Army Reserve, said last week that without a, quote, civil affairs surge, that would train doctors, lawyers, police, bankers, teachers to run Iraq, a military surge becomes ineffective. Was that addressed at today's hearing? You know, the idea that it's that there's got to be something parallel to the troop surge on which all the attention is focused.
That has always been true, and the problem is as one senior general told me the other day, the window is rapidly closing for that kind of activity. That would have been great in 2003 after the invasion, but what most people now recognize is the Bush administration failed to provide those resources and provide that mindset at the time it was needed. So teachers and kind of hearts and minds and engaging in a civil affairs fashion is exactly what you need for a counterinsurgency like what's going on in Iraq, but 4 years late doesn't work so well.
Gordon Leubold of the Christian Science Monitor speaking to us about today's House Committee on Foreign Affairs hearing. Gordon, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as more Republicans raise their voices against the war in Iraq, some are also reported to be eyeing the war's architect, Vice President Dick Cheney. Washington insider Sally Quinn writes in the Washington Post that Republicans are trying to figure out a way to remove Cheney from office, some Republicans. A possible opportunity when the vice president undergoes surgery to replace his pacemaker battery, and a possible replacement for Cheney, former senator and possible presidential candidate Fred Thompson. And today there's news that Democrats are moving to strip Dick Cheney of his executive branch funding and perks, since Cheney claimed recently his office is not part of the executive branch as a way to avoid disclosure requirements for documents related to national security. Well, today we're going to have a conversation about the vice president with Julian Zelitzer. He's formerly of Boston University, now professor of history and public affairs at Princeton, co-editor of the book Politics and Society in 20th Century America. Julian joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And first of all, have you ever seen this much focus on a sitting president?
Vice president.
Yeah,
we've had. I mean, Vice President Agnew of Richard Nixon's presidency was forced to resign because of a scandal. Nelson Rockefeller, who's the vice president for Gerald Ford, becomes very polarizing. Conservatives hate him. And Al Gore also was pretty polarizing. He was seen as a very strong vice president. But Dick Cheney is in a league of his own.
Well, it's funny that I stumbled and said president, because Some said that it is a shadow presidency. And there's been a four-part series in the Washington Post we want to talk about. But has any vice president ever been removed? Sally Quinn says that many Republicans are talking about that because they view Cheney as toxic, and as the administration's leading proponent of an attack on Iran, he's seen as dangerous by some. But as she writes, removing a sitting vice president is not easy.
No, and I think what you have here is a vice president who has made the office into something much bigger than it ever was. It was always seen really as an insignificant position. Who would want to remove a vice president? And now we have a case where you can easily confuse the term president and vice president. So it won't be easy, and there'll be resistance, and we'll see if Democrats want to invest a lot of their energy in this.
Well, just to fill out her thoughts, she says that this group of party elders is led by Senator John Warner that could well do this, And John Warner's name has been mentioned by many as the fellow who could possibly be the Fulbright of the current crop of lawmakers. Senator Fulbright, of course, the one who went in and told the then president, we can no longer support Vietnam.
Right. And the equivalent a little later would be Senator Goldwater, who told Richard Nixon he was going to have to resign because things had become too bad for the party. It's unclear, though, whether, you know, a Senator Warner has that kind of hold on the White House. The fact is that Vice President Cheney is not going to give in very easily, and President Bush is very loyal to him. And in some ways, having him resign is a sign of defeat, not only for the administration, but for everything that the president has tried to achieve, because Cheney is the face of the Bush administration.
Well, let's go to the second thing that's being sort of buzzed about in Washington today, which is that Democrats are moving to propose that Dick Cheney's executive privileges and perks and funding be removed, since his White House counsel said that the vice presidency is a unique office that is neither a part of the executive branch nor a part of the legislative branch. This led to a cartoon in the Post that shows a tree, and it has the four branches of government: judicial, legislative, executive, and Cheney. How unusual. I mean, what does that mean? If he's saying that he's not a part of the executive branch or the legislative. The executive branch, of course, he's claiming, Cheney and his counsel are claiming, free him from the disclosure requests.
Right. I mean, I think part is just a rhetorical game trying to prevent him from having to give in information that's required of all executive agencies because of an executive order that Bush agreed to in 2003. That said, this whole issue, is he beholden to anyone, I think symbolizes a lot of the frustration people have with Vice President Cheney. The idea that he does not feel obligated to any laws or any kind of oversight, and that gets back into the issue that are leading some Republicans to say it's time to move forward.
Right. The perks, by the way, Air Force Two, the mansion off Massachusetts Avenue, West Wing office, huge staff. Again, a move to remove the funding. And a White House spokesperson has said this is just symbolic and political games that they're playing. But there's some very serious issues at hand. We mentioned the Washington Post series, and we'll have a link to that at our website, here-now.org. Give us your sense of the overarching thought behind the series. We know a lot. We know that Dick Cheney has, since he was in the Ford administration, wanted to rejigger the executive privilege. But what did you take away from, you know, this huge account of his term in the vice presidency?
It's a terrific series. I mean, I think, as you said, we've known that he believes in executive power, and he's been fighting for it tooth and nail since the days of Ford, since his days in Congress in the 1980s with Iran-Contra. But what we see in the articles is how he's doing it and how he's really operated behind the scenes to achieve really big changes in environmental policy and policies dealing with terrorism, and that all this talk about his power is not just rhetorical. It's not just conspiratorial talk. This is a very smooth operator. He's quite skilled at what he's done.
But I want to ask you something, and we'll talk about some of the specifics that are raised in the post. But I found myself reading it with a whole bunch of viewpoints, and one of them is if you're a real supporter of Dick Cheney and of the issues that he intervened on, whether they're environment, you know, getting the ban on snowmobiles in national parks lifted, whether they're the torture memo. You think, wow, you think it's laudatory. It's a laudatory article. You're nodding yes.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is about a very skilled politician, a liberal reading about a liberal vice president or policymaker who achieved these goals behind the scenes, I think would read it positively as well. And that's part, I think, of what makes him scary to his opponents. He's not just in a different political position, but he's very politically skilled and savvy. And the articles show it very clearly.
But was there anything, you know, does the article show that there's anything, what's the word I'm looking for? Certainly not criminal, you know, but, you know, as an historian, how do you read it?
He operates in the gray areas very well. And so you don't come away always with this is illegal or even this is, you know, firmly unethical. I think that's part of his skill. He pushes the limits of what's okay to do, and he stops. And it's in that area he's able to achieve his goals. So you don't come away with a smoking gun that this is someone who could be impeached.
Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. We're going to, after the break, talk to him more about just what are some of the things that Dick Cheney was behind that you may not have known and what the future may hold. Be right back, right after a break. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with more from Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, also co-editor of the book Politics and Society in 20th Century America. And we've been talking about Vice President Dick Cheney, who's very much in the spotlight in a four-day Washington Post series. We can link you to it at our website, here-now.org. And light shining on him from other places, as well as the vice president says that he is not a part of the executive branch or the legislative branch of government. The series, Julian, is called Angler. That's Cheney's Secret Service name. And, of course, he's known for being a fisherman and outdoorsman, also the first vice president since Aaron Burr to actually shoot someone that we know of. That was, of course, when he mistakenly shot someone while hunting. But here's a couple of other things that the Washington Post series points out that he has done. He expanded the president's authority to make war, was responsible for the president's order that terrorism suspects held by the U.S. would be stripped of access to U.S. courts and held indefinitely, been a gatekeeper for Supreme Court nominees, settled cabinet turf disputes, editor of tax proposals, regulator in chief of water flows in his native West. You know, there's a scene where Colin Powell looks up and is watching television and says, what the heck just happened? When he's finding out, as does Condoleezza Rice, that Dick Cheney has intervened on an issue. Does that, though, make him the shadow president?
No, it doesn't make him the shadow president. And when I read the articles, you still come away wondering exactly what his relationship is with the president. You know, there's other accounts saying the president keeps a tight leash on Dick Cheney, and that while Cheney is promoting this and helping him achieve policies, that President Bush has also been quite forceful. And none of the issues you raised are that much of a surprise. I mean, the article shows how he did it, but we've known these things. So it's not so much of a shadow presidency, if you've heard about it, you know, at least for 6 years, if not longer.
Was there anything that jumped out at you that surprised you?
Well, some of the things that surprised me were things he hasn't achieved. He's been frustrated with the expansion of government under President Bush. And there's a couple pieces where he's talking about big government conservatism taking place, and there was nothing much he could do about it. A real frustration that he actually had when he worked for Gerald Ford. And another is, you know, his diminishing clout as the scandals over torture and the war on terrorism have increased. In a sense, within the White House, he has lost some of his capital, which I don't think has been as clear in the reporting until now.
Well, and the Washington Post makes clear that President Bush does set his own course. It's not always the course that Dick Cheney wants.
Exactly. And you know, this is part of what we'll learn as the historians read this. But usually that's the case. Even with very powerful figures in an administration, vice president or otherwise, presidents still usually will call the shots about what or what is not going to happen.
Well, and yet, you know, a lot of power. Christine Todd Whitman, former head of the EPA, recalls pressure from Cheney, him calling her on her vacation, August 2001. 7 months into the first term, when Cheney wanted to know why the EPA was, in his view, dragging its feet on easing pollution rules for aging power and oil refinery plants, an industry that obviously contributed heavily to the Bush-Cheney campaign. And, you know, the Post claims that that is pressure from Cheney is why she quit, not personal matters.
Right. And you know what you get? Often vice presidents are the aggressors in an administration. Richard Nixon, when he worked for Eisenhower, went on the campaign trail and would say things Eisenhower would never say. Agnew did the same for Nixon. But what you see with Cheney is he does this not just on the campaign trail, but in terms of public policy, like EPA issues. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where he's taking the vice presidency to a new level.
Right. And what does it mean for future vice presidents?
Well, I think the power he's built will continue. I mean, usually the way these institutions work is when they become more powerful, it's hard to make them weaker. And even though he's polarizing and even though he's controversial, I think he's now set a precedent. I think we have to look at who the vice president's going to be pretty seriously from now on.
And how do you think his counsel's claim that he's not a part of the executive or legislative branch is going to shake out?
I don't think that's going to shake out at all, especially since one of his, you know, signature claims is how powerful the vice president should be and that he should enjoy the benefits of executive power and executive privilege. So to do this, an about face like this, I don't think makes much sense. You know, the only people who like it are the late night comedians.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, we began by saying that there's a move by Republicans to consider removing him from office, and they see an opportunity because he has to, I guess, be sidelined for surgery this summer. And they also see an opportunity because previously they didn't see any candidate to put in his place. But now Fred Thompson's come into the presidential race, and they view that as a possibility. You see any chance of there being any shift, major, major shift in the White House in this administration prior to the elections?
Well, you might if the shift in Congress takes place. I mean, what you've now seen is the first open breaks from Republicans on Iraq. I mean, everyone was predicting it for this summer, and it's starting to happen. If that increases come September, come the budget battles that are going to take place over military spending, the White House won't have any choice. It's going to be pretty hard for them. You know, if the Democrats have a veto-proof Congress, a veto-proof Senate, the White House will have to change course.
Julian Zelitzer, I'm going to switch gears on you because there's something we just wanted to air today, and you're here. And your comment on it would be valuable as well. Real switch of gears. We want to turn to the flap between Elizabeth Edwards, wife of the Democratic presidential candidate John Edwards, and conservative commentator Ann Coulter. Coulter said this week that she wished John Edwards had been killed by terrorists. This is after she'd used an anti-gay slur against Edwards. We remember that. And also had criticized Edwards and his wife, said they manipulated the fact that one of their children had been killed in a car accident. Last night on Hardball on MSNBC, Coulter was a guest, and Elizabeth called in to ask Coulter to stop the personal attacks. Let's listen.
It debases political dialogue. It draws people away from the process. We can't have a debate about issue if you're using this kind of language.
Yeah, why isn't John Edwards making this call?
Because, well, do you want to respond? We'll end this conversation.
I haven't talked to
John
about this call.
I think this is just another attempt.
I'm making this call as a mother. I'm the mother.
Coulter went on to say that she felt Elizabeth Edwards was trying to make her stop speaking. You know, it was a freedom of speech issue. Commentators are saying Elizabeth Edwards sounded pretty terrific in coming out and asking to stop this kind of language. Have you ever seen anything like that? I mean, is this something you're shaking your head?
No, it's an interesting. It was very interesting to watch. I mean, this is the. It's actually not unrelated to Cheney. Same kind of polarization, same kind of anger on both sides. Now you're seeing it with the spouse of a candidate and a talk show host. I think Coulter embodies the same kind of politics that some say Dick Cheney embodies, and that's how this all relates and is all part of 2008.
We'll see how it will play out in 2008. Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton, and co-editor of the book Politics and Society in 20th Century America. Thanks, as always, for weighing in on all of this.
Thank you.
Stay with us. More after the news here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. When the investment firm The Blackstone Group offered its previously private and very lucrative stock to the public late last week, lawmakers began churning out proposed legislation designed to tap into the income generated by huge equity firms like Blackstone. Blackstone's shares soared more than 13% on its first day of public trading, boosting the partnership's market value to nearly $40 billion. They've since dropped. The bills would change the tax structure and force private equity groups and hedge fund firms to pay the corporate tax rate instead of the lower capital gains rate they currently pay. Measures were introduced by lawmakers in the Senate and the House, and joining us is one of them, Peter Welch, Democrat from Vermont. Congressman Welch, welcome.
It's good to be with you.
And let's see if we understand this. Equity firms like Blackstone pay different tax rates than corporations that, say, make a product as opposed to making money. And private equity managers pay taxes on capital gains rather than treating their huge incomes as salaries, so they pay far less there as well. And we understand the supporters say this is great because these companies fuel the economy, and that low tax structure is incentive for people to invest in these companies and help them do their work of buying companies and fueling the economy. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, it boils down to two things that are really quite simple. Number one, if you have a corporation that is providing financial services on the one hand, number two, you have a partnership organized under an obscure provision in the tax code doing the identical same work, but they're real competitors. Should you have taxes assessed against the profits of both of those entities that are the same because they're doing the same work? I'll just give you a vivid example. Goldman Sachs, for instance, does financial services and investment advising and hedge fund type activity, among other things. They had income of about $14.5 billion. They paid the corporate tax rate of 34%, or about $5 billion. Blackstone, on an annual basis, had about $4.4 billion. They paid $57 million in taxes, or 1.3%.
Yeah, give me that comparison again, the percentage from Goldman Sachs to Blackstone.
34% of the corporate tax is what Goldman paid. 1.3% is what Blackstone paid. Yeah. Now, the Blackstone folks think that's great, but they literally do the same identical business.
You have another comparison. You mentioned the Goldman Sachs, but you also took the federal tax burden of a typical family of four in your home state, Vermont,
right,
and compared their gross income and the taxes they paid and the resulting net income with what the Blackstone Group paid. This was based on second quarter earnings for fiscal 2007.
Right.
What was the comparison there?
Well, the comparison is this. A Vermont family, a two-income family, might have a gross income of $71,000. So you might have a teacher and a firefighter. They'd have taxable income of about $48,000. They would pay, just in federal taxes, 13.4% versus Blackstone at 1.3%.
By the way, we've talked about how the managers of, let's say, Blackstone are taking their income not as salary but as capital gains. What just throw some of those numbers around again. What are some of the incomes?
Well, the incomes are vast. I mean, this public offering, one of the partners in Blackstone is going to, I guess, be worth $7, $8 billion. If you could handle this, if you had enough savings, you'd say, hey, look, don't pay me my salary this year. Wait a year. okay?
Right.
So then when you, I'll only pay capital gain, lower rate on my salary rather than my income tax rate.
Well, I must say, I'm going to jump in here. I must say that, you know, it does boggle the mind. You know, you wonder, how is it possible that this has happened, that one sort of company pays, you know, fewer taxes than another company, and yet one of the other things they come back with is, well, these are huge investments that we make financially for these private equity firms and now public equity firms. This is, you know, huge amounts of money that people put up. They take the risk, so there should be some compensation for that.
Well, they get compensation, but the whole rationale in our tax system for giving a preferential lower rate to a capital gain is that you, the investor, have put your money at risk. The hedge fund people are not investing their money. They're investing your money. So they're risking your money but asking to get the benefit of your risk and pay capital gain rates instead of income tax rate on the 20% fee that you pay them, basically for advising you where to risk your money. So it's a real self-serving distortion of the rationale of capital gains. My view is that if a hedge fund manager wants to put his or her money at risk, then fine, they get the capital gain treatment, and they get taxed at the 15% rate. But if all they're doing is putting my money or your money at risk, and they're providing a service, investment advising service, then they should pay income tax rates just like any other investment advisor.
And that's up to 35% on the fee.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. Well, do you worry that right now these stocks, you know, Wall Street is looking at this company and other companies, because there's others in line, at the current tax rates, and that's how the stocks are being valued. But as legislation like yours comes around, people worry that these companies are going to crash already since last week. Blackstone was selling at 7.5% less than it was last Friday when it first went public, and some are blaming legislators like you filing these tax equity bills. So there's just a perception that to hurt these companies is to hurt the economy.
If we have to make tax policy based on whether the market's going up or down, then obviously you're throwing fairness aside. That's a governmental distortion of the marketplace. Now, if the stock market is adjusting to the reality that Congress wants a level playing field, then the market will adjust and take that into account. It may have an impact on the stock price of those entities like Blackstone that have basically been getting, I guess I'd have to call it a free ride. Then that's an appropriate adjustment for the market to make.
How do you see, you know, even let's say your legislation, your proposal for tax equity does pass, do you see it passing the White House? President Bush has promised to veto any, you know, sort of tax increases, and this would be read as that.
I'd have a hard time seeing the president veto something where we're basically establishing a level playing field, but that'll be up to the president.
Peter Welch, a Democrat, is a congressman from the state of Vermont. For more on his proposal, go to our website, here-now.org. Congressman Welch, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
And a quick look at some other business news. ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips have decided to pull out of Venezuela rather than sign over majority stakes in oil projects to that country's state-owned oil company. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has been ramping up his nationalization efforts since winning re-election last December, saying such moves help to restore the nation's sovereignty on its march to socialism. And Venezuela isn't alone in such moves. Countries with abundant natural resources are revisiting contracts signed when commodity prices were lower, and some nations offered generous terms to attract Western investment. And before we go today, to make something so confusing or murky that it's hard to understand or see. Well, perhaps it's something that we inadvertently do, but we try not to. That's the definition. What is the word? And that's the idea behind Definathon, the spelling bee of definitions. And by the way, the word I just defined is obfuscate. We'll talk about more words and their definitions before we go. You're listening to Here and Now. The Air Transport Association predicts that 209 million passengers are going to take a flight on U.S. airlines this summer, leaving a lot of greenhouse gas in their wake. Well, now when travelers make their reservations, in addition to buying flight insurance or booking a rental car, they have the choice of buying carbon offsets designed to reduce the gases caused by their travel. Right now, by most estimates, airlines create about 3% of the carbon emissions that contribute to global warming. But that figure is expected to rise as the number of annual flights is expected to double in the next 20 years. So, aisle, window, or carbon offset? We turn now to Khalil Sakakini, content editor for TravelVideoPostcard.com. And Khalil, first of all, just tell us how these carbon offsets, you know, how the airlines and others claim that they are supposed to work.
What it is basically is that a person can enter into a website, where they're leaving from, where they're going to. The computer then spits out personal emissions, miles flown, personal fuel use, and then calculates that and says for X number of dollars, you can buy a carbon offset so that your flight is carbon neutral. And that money then goes to carbon reduction programs so that you can fly with a free conscience.
A lot of these companies that have these websites, you can do this, you know, we've spoken of this, you can do it for your home, you can do it for your own personal life, but
yes,
this is specifically for travel. So is this on the airline, you know, on the airline website? Do you do it when you buy your ticket?
Some of the big online websites like Orbitz and Travelocity and Expedia say that they have integrated the carbon offset option. I'm not altogether sure that's true because yesterday when I called Expedia two or three times to talk to the customer service people, they weren't aware of it.
So what you're finding is that this may not have filtered down to the customer reps, but according to reports, when you buy a ticket through Expedia, Travelocity, Orbitz, they will have a link for you as you purchase your ticket and you can do your carbon offset there. But we understand carriers, and one of them is Delta, also have that option.
Yes. In some cases, it's built into the booking system, and in some cases, as an Orbitz, they will take you to a website where you can conduct a transaction.
Okay. But, you know, this gets us to some of the questions that are raised about carbon offsets in general. You know, what are some of the questions that are raised about carbon offsetting?
Yeah, I have to tell you, the airlines are really terrified. The International Air Transport Association, which represents all the airlines in the world, and they had a meeting in Lisbon, and they were very, very, very uptight because they fear people will end up saying, save the planet, travel less. Don't take a trip, reduce global warming.
Right.
So they're terrified because travel will increase, especially as Asia or India and China in particular come on board and begin to travel extensively. So some people are saying, look, this is a feel-good fiction. This carbon offset program makes you feel good. It eases your conscience. But whether it has any measurable impact on the environment and carbon dioxide emissions, there are other ways of making a better impact.
Well, but then we also read Eric Carlson, who's executive director of CarbonFund.org. That's another group. He says, hey, wait, you do have the chance to do something. Remember recycling? People thought that wouldn't catch on. And that it sends a powerful message to politicians if people start to do this and could ultimately end up making a difference.
Yes. CarbonFund.org is a nonprofit, and I tend to like their approach, but I don't want it to be a red herring in which it distracts the airline industry from dealing with other issues such as making more fuel-efficient planes,
right,
lighter planes, using less congested airports.
Well, and by the way, these carbon offset companies themselves have become controversial. There's no oversight, no regulatory agency, although we understand the Center for Resource Solutions, and they want to put in place a program that will certify carbon offset companies. So that's coming.
Yes, I also see that a company called Environmental Resources Trust is an auditing company. And that's what our listeners should be conscious of. When they buy a carbon offset, be certain that the company they buy it from, they know specifically where the money is going, what kinds of projects they're investing the money in. Because, as someone said, it takes 70 years for a single tree to filter out the amount of CO2 produced by one flight. You know, is the impact cumulatively worth it? I think your point is a good one. It probably is. But if people are thinking there's going to be an instant fix, well, 7 years is a long time for a tree to pay back what you've paid. So.
Mm-hmm. Khalil Sakakini, content editor for TravelVideoPostcard.com, speaking about the ways that air travelers can buy carbon offsets to neutralize or somewhat offset the amount of greenhouse gases that their flights create. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Khalil, thanks as always.
Always my pleasure, Robin. Thanks.
Up next, what's the meaning of fusty? We'll find out in our Define-a-thon after the break, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Who would have thought? Dictionaries as mass entertainment. But look at all the hubbub over the televised Scripps National Spelling Bee. And while knowing how to spell parthenogenesis and darmstadtium is impressive, it pales in comparison to knowing what those words mean. So enter another competition. The editors of the American Heritage Dictionary have created the Define-a-thon, a new word game focusing on vocabulary with actual Define-a-thon events held across the country. Steve Kleinedler is senior editor at the American Heritage Dictionary and Define-a-thon host. Steve, welcome.
Thank you, Robin, for having me in.
The game comes in books, a kit, and as we said, events. I have the Define-a-thon dictionary for high school graduates right here, as opposed to the one for freshmen. You give a definition in four words that might fit that definition. Then later on, you give the answer in the book. Let's go through some of these now to give people
yes.
a taste. How about reading number 43?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The definition is a person who attacks and opposes popular or traditional beliefs, ideas, or practices.
Mm-hmm.
And here are your choices. Iconoclast, ideologue, intercessor, or introvert.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Iconoclast.
That is correct.
Yep. And by the way, back in the book, you also give the definitions of the other words, but we won't do that now.
Right.
We'll keep going. Would you read my favorite, which is number 33?
Yes. Number 33, the definition is smelling of mildew or decay, moldy. And the choices are decadent, fusty, numinous, or reticulate.
I have to say, I had no idea what this was, so I looked in the back, and not only do we find that something that smells of mildew or decay, moldy, is something that's fusty, but you give us a beautiful reading from the bell jar. And that word's in it. Let me read just a little bit. This is Sylvia Plath writing. It's the summer the Rosenbergs were electrocuted, and she's going to the subway station, and she says, the idea of being electrocuted makes me sick, and that's all there was to read about in the papers, goggle-eyed headlines staring up at me on every street corner and at the fusty, peanut-smelling mouth of every subway. What a sentence.
It's great. It's the first or second paragraph of the book, and it really sets the scene, and it's so well written. I really like her writing style. And I remember I only read this novel for the first time a couple years ago. And when I came across that word, it's like this word deserves to be in our compilations that we do like this. And so I gave it a place.
Yeah. This is a word that deserves knowledge of it. By the way, the other words, decadent, in a condition of deterioration, numinous, filled with or characterized by a sense of a supernatural presence, reticulate, resembling or forming a net or network. So those were not the right answers.
Right.
Fusty, smelling of mildew. What a great word. What great word, but also great idea. How'd you come about it?
Well, several years ago when we were promoting the American Heritage College Dictionary in 2002, we had a word list of 100 words we thought every high school graduate should know. Just a list. It was a poster. It went to book sales, book conferences, teacher associations, and the poster was very popular. We kept getting requests for it, so we put the words up on our website, and we ultimately turned it into a book, 100 Words Every High School Graduate Should Know, and that became a series. There are 6 or 7 books in the series now, and last year I had gone across the country doing some spelling bees in conjunction with the new printing of the American Heritage Dictionary, and in marketing, they thought, well, you know, we've done these spelling things. What if we took vocabulary items, if we took definitions and did something out of that. So the editors compiled a long string of vocabulary words, and we came up with questions, and it became an event and a book.
And a handy little public relations device.
Absolutely.
You know, well, it makes me wonder, all these events with spelling and now vocabulary, one would think the dictionary is an endangered species because of the internet, but is part of it to drive people to sites on the internet, or are you just hoping that people will buy dictionaries as well as get involved with the words?
Well, there are several things going on here. Obviously, the internet plays a part, and we certainly license our content to many online providers. So there's a time and a place for looking up information online and for using a book. As more and more people turn to the web to get this type of information, something that's being lost is the art of being lost in a dictionary, looking mm-hmm. up a word in print, looking at what falls on the page around it, and learning all the stuff you didn't know. So what these books do is they browse the dictionary for you. and you learned facts about words that you didn't know. For example, here we show all the etymologies, that is, the histories of the words, how these words entered English from Latin or Greek or Akkadian mm-hmm. or wherever they came from. In the case of the word fusty, you know, we give you a nice example of it being used in context by a known author.
Mm-hmm. I've seen pictures of the event and people are, you know, jumping for joy because they've got the definition right. What are some of the toughest, you know, words in the Definathon, some that jump out?
It's divided into three levels, and we start out easy and work our way up. And by the time we get to the last level, they are what I call impossibly hard. If we're stuck at six people and we need to winnow it down to one, they're the type of questions that I ask specifically to knock out as much people as possible.
Well, no, you have some from the kit, right? The kit has these hard...
Yes.
Hard, okay, well, all right. So I'm willing to be embarrassed. Okay, go ahead.
All right. The migratory drive in animals, especially birds. Would that be zootechny, tsuchinrua, zygapophysis, or zymosis?
I'm looking at Vince, the board operator. He's looking at me like, I don't know. Say them again.
The migratory drive in animals, especially birds. Zootechny, tsuchinrua, zygapophysis, or zymosis?
Oh, God, I think, you know, zoo, but that's animals. So I don't know. That doesn't sound birdish. And none of them sound like they even should be words. They should be more like how it sounds when you sneeze. Since I think it's the zoo one, I'm going to go with the zy.
Zymosis? No, it's tsuchinrua, which is a nice Zugunrue.
Oh, come on.
It's from the German.
Of course. I knew that.
Well, I could give you one that's more in the humanities, an Englishy thing. The use of a word or phrase in a sense contrary to its normal meaning for ironic or humorous effect, as in a mere babe of 40 years. Would that...
Wait a minute. I have challenges of that sentence, but go ahead.
All right. Anacoluthin, antiphrasis, catachresis, or prosopopoeia? You see, we these are designed to eliminate people when we've been doing this for 35
well,
or 40
I'm
minutes.
Out. I'll go with that last one.
Prosopopoeia? No, it's antiphrasis.
Sure. Oh, because yes. antiph, the anti
yes.
part.
When I was in Chicago 2 weeks ago at the Printers Row Book Festival, the winner was a classics major, and basically he parsed the etymologies of practically every word.
Right.
He was able to win just by knowing Greek and Latin. They're not all Greek and Latin, but many of them, of course, are.
I just have to ask you before you go. I mean, obviously you're someone who loves words. And you're seeing words, you know, reach the status of, oh, who knows, perhaps there will be a Definathon, you know, on national TV. Do I understand you have a phonetic vowel chart tattooed on your back?
That is correct.
Okay. Can I see it?
Honestly, it's fairly old. It's like 14 or 15 years old. It's only got two colors. It looks kind of lame. It sounds far cooler than it actually is.
Well, tell me.
It's a trapezoid shape which represents your oral cavity, and then there are six symbols representing the cardinal vowels in schwa, which is the position of your tongue in your mouth when you make the vowel sounds a, e, e, o, u, and a.
It's on your back?
It's tattooed on my back.
Well, that's going to be a conversation starter.
It is, yeah.
Oh, you dictionary people. Steve Kleinedler, a lexicographer and supervising editor of the American Heritage Dictionaries. He edited the American Heritage Dictionary Definathon for the high school freshman and for the high school graduate. Steve, what a pleasure to visit with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Can I just see it?
All right.
Well, there you go. Okay.
Yeah, I told you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.